a tribute to Linda McCartney. Richard Rodney Bennett's A Good Night with Paul Brough there conducting the BBC Singers. A few words now from Ian McMillan.
I'm here to tell you there's still time to enter this year's Proms Poetry Competition. All you have to do is write a poem inspired by any piece of music in this year's Proms season. There are two categories, one for children and one for adults. And the winners will have their poems read out at a Proms Plus event and then broadcast on Radio 3. Oh, and they'll also get to meet me, which is a prize in itself. For details of how to enter, including full terms and conditions, visit bbc.co.uk/proms or simply type Proms Poetry Competition into your search engine. The closing date is the 9th of August, so get writing. And I personally would love to get poems from people who've never written a poem before. Go on, have a go. Now, what rhymes with Benjamin Britten?
BBC Radio 3, it's a little after 10 past 10, and time now for Georgia Mann to introduce another of our Proms Plus late sessions, recorded last week at the Royal Albert Hall's Elgar Room.
Hello and welcome to tonight's Proms Plus Late, where poetry and music come together alongside the gleaming red piano and under the moody, bluey, pink lights of the Elgar Room upstairs at the Royal Albert Hall. It was Allen Ginsberg who first wrote about floating across the tops of cities contemplating jazz. And the jazz that we'll be contemplating tonight will be brought to you by the Sam Watts Quintet, with Sam at the aforementioned ruby red piano. At the ripe old age of 24, Sam's already played everywhere from the Wigmore Hall to the Symphony Hall in Birmingham. He's also a pianist in residence at the legendary Savoy Hotel in London. And appropriately, he cites a cocktail of influences. We've got everything in there, from tango to silent movie soundtracks to Brazilian choro music. And the band tonight are made up of real all-stars who are kind of Sam's fellow alumni from the Royal Academy of Music. And there's also a Berklee College of Music grad. He's the one holding the guitar. And our poet this evening is Amy Blakemore, who started writing poetry after coming across our very own poet laureate, Carol Ann Duffy's work. Yes, you're cringing now, Amy. During her GCSE. And it actually got her to thinking, this poetry writing lark is actually not that hard. I'll give it a go. And obviously, her initial assessment was correct, because she has since gone on to be cited as one of the rising stars in British poetry by The Guardian. Her work's been anthologised in Blood Axe's 21 Poets for the 21st Century, and she's also read her work at the Latitude Festival. And we'll be hearing Amy in action very soon. But first, it is the Sam Watts Quintet. We have Sam Watts on piano, Thomas Seminar Ford on guitar, Lucia Capellaro on cello, Flo Moore on bass, and Ben Brown on drums.
Thank you.
We have an exclusive collaboration, and Sam and Thomas on guitar are going to be sort of improvising beautifully and dexterously beneath Amy as she reads her poem, Charlie.
A séance with a true spirit of romance. Byron, perhaps, one club foot in the grave, his ripped woolen sodden with earth and syphilis. Our gods turn away. They will not accept your noontide sacrifice of quail's eggs and soda bread. This is what you wanted all along. Eros stink, the darkness of the forest by the motorway. To be high as lilacs on our college walls. And with hell scrawled on bare chest, to writhe like frost round the railings at night. Starving for abandonment, a dress all torn to waif by apple moths. Eat mummy powders for the ache of what it is, our head shaved to tatters. Pretend it is midnight and we are in a meadow. I turn it into songs to pass Saharan numbing time. Before you are an old and wet-lipped man. Until then, it is always Thursday, and we have no plan. And so that youth might thoroughly be thought true paradise, let us carry age, gnarled snake, in us all. Thank you.
Thank you.
called replacement service. Blithe on the axis of snowburst, fur coat, cigarette smoke, archway turned muscovite with seagull puff and sleaze, my markless boy, asking who drags this sudden knife of white, who planned this intrusion of the world beyond the given. This one's new, it doesn't have a title. Maybe it will never have a title. So there. I will hunt you in the mountains, my sweet sideways child, with your nipples fun and obvious, your residential legs. Are you in the baby's bedroom or orchestrating a storm at sea? Don't talk. I don't want your roadkill opinions, the convictions that you suppose are strange and beautiful. It is your eyes that kill me, those stars raked up from hell. Thank you.
Fantastic. Amy Blakemore. Thank you very much, Amy.
Thank you.
That was another Proms Plus Late session recorded last week at the Royal Albert Hall's Elgar Room with the Sam Watts Quintet and the poet Amy Blakemore. It was introduced by Georgia Mann.
It's about sharing the music that we both love and putting them together.
There really has never been a gig like this, I think, because there'll be fans of both sorts of music, from classical music to some of the artists we play on Six Music, and I think we're all in for a surprise. I'm Steve Lamack.
And I'm Tom Service.
We may come from different ends of the radio dial, but Radio 3 and Radio 6 Music share a common passion, music.
Join us live on both stations for the Six Music Prom. We'll have live music from the Stranglers, Laura Marling and Kerris Matthews, all performing with the London Sinfonietta.
Six Music and Radio 3 present the Six Music Prom.
Monday night on BBC Radio 3 at 10:15.
Back to this Wednesday night. An English song now, between now and the essay at 10:45. British mezzo-soprano Jennifer Johnston is in her final year as one of the Radio 3 new generation artists, and she's appearing at two BBC proms over the coming weeks. One of them brings the world premiere of Anthony Payne's orchestration of Vaughan Williams' Four Last Songs. And Vaughan Williams from Jennifer now. Early Vaughan Williams, these songs are all from the first decade of the 20th century, and there are four altogether here. The second is The Sky Above the Roof, So Blue, So Calm, and the last of them, Lyndon Lee. And the other two are from Vaughan Williams' collection, Songs of Travel, setting poems by Robert Louis Stevenson. Let Beauty Awake, that's the third song. And first of all, a view of the immutability of nature, the infinite shining heavens. Jennifer Johnston here with the pianist Alistair Hogarth. Thank you. Lyndon Lee, the very first song Vaughan Williams had published. That was in 1901, and can any first song, including its various subsequent arrangements, ever have been so successful. The words are by the Dorset poet William Barnes. Before it, you heard three other Vaughan Williams songs, Let Beauty Awake, The Sky Above the Roof, and at the start, The Infinite Shining Heavens. The pianist was Alistair Hogarth, and the singer, mezzo-soprano Jennifer Johnston, one of Radio 3's current new generation artists. And Jennifer's appearing at two BBC proms over the coming weeks. She's one of the soloists in this Sunday's Beethoven Ninth Symphony, the other soloists including two former new generation artists, Lisa Milne and Andrew Kennedy. And then a few weeks on, Jennifer's singing Vaughan Williams' Four Last Songs. That's a world premiere for Anthony Payne's orchestration of them. And the prom is on Wednesday, the 4th of September. What at the Royal Albert Hall tomorrow night?
After an absence of almost 20 years, piano soloist Mitsuko Uchida returns to the BBC Proms, playing Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 4 in the first of two BBC Proms concerts given by the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra and its chief conductor Marius Janssens. A pair of concerts culminating with Mahler's Second Symphony, The Resurrection, on Friday. Join me, Christopher Cook, for the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra at the Proms on BBC Radio 3 tomorrow night from 7 o'clock.
Minuet in C-sharp minor by Maurice Ravel. It was played there by Stephen Osborne. BBC Radio 3, it's a 10:45, and now another chance to hear the fourth in a series of essays considering the exuberant play of Edward Lear as a nonsense poet and artist and the influence of nonsense on modern life. This evening, art historian Caroline Arscott considers Edward Lear as an artist.
Edward Lear was well known as an artist long before he became famous for his writing. He first made his name as an illustrator of rare and beautiful birds and animals, parrots, owls, monkeys, for books designed to appeal to the scientific naturalist and arouse the wonder of the art collector. The illustrations were based on drawings, rendered in black and white as lithographs, and then, once printed, hand-coloured. Lear didn't always get full recognition for his role in the illustrations. Sometimes the scientific author claimed credit. Or else, as in the case of the Book of Tortoises, Turtles and Terrapins, first issued as a part work in 1832-6, Lear was indicated just as the lithographer. But Lear lent his sense of quirky individuality to all of the plates he worked on. The tortoises are immense characters whose complex markings and smooth or knobbly shells command the page and occupy the viewer's attention. Some appear to be lifted into the air. Others throw a slight shadow on the ground. We get a sense of Lear's input in the gleam of a tortoise's eye, its splay-legged stance, the hint of a grimace in the leathery features. He caught the idiosyncratic animation of these cold-blooded creatures. The land tortoises moved with deliberation, but could put on a surprising turn of speed, making, as the scientific author Bell explained, an almost ludicrous attempt at vivacity. In some cases, the underside is shown, with the creature's neck, legs and tail showing. Here, the kicking motion of stubby legs and the undulations of the surface of the shell contribute to a lively and disconcerting view of the creature, such as the Indian freshwater tortoise with long, sharp claws, or a Nile turtle, beautiful on the top side where spotty markings cluster like shining stars in a night sky, but grotesque and hard to read on the pallid underside. I think that in these zoological illustrations, we can see Lear's regard for beauty in variety in the natural world, along with an empathetic sense for the creature's subjective existence. There is also a sense of mischief, an appreciation of the destabilizing possibilities of a flipped-over perspective that informs the topsy-turvy world of Lear's nonsense. In fact, the tortoises and turtles reappear in his nonsense verse. In one nonsense alphabet, the tortoise is manic in his animation, rearing up onto his back legs with sticks held by the forefeet, as the tumultuous Tom-Tommy tortoise who beat a drum all day in the wilderness. The boxy tortoise beats a boxy drum as if assaulting an image of himself. Another tortoise is the steed of an old person of Ickley, in a limerick who couldn't abide to ride quickly. Here the proverbial slowness of tortoise locomotion is the point. The old person is shown with deranged, sliding eyes, whip in hand, aiming to go to Karnak on a tortoise's back, thereby heading back in time to early stages of civilization in ancient Egypt. Edward Lear selected a marine turtle for a key role in the nonsense poem The Courtship of the Yongi Bongi Bo. As the courtship of Lady Jingly fails, the Yongi Bongi Bo flees on the back of a lively turtle. Through the silent roaring ocean did the turtle swiftly go. Holding fast upon his shell rode the Yongi Bongi Bo. With a sad primeval motion towards the sunset isles of Boshen, still the turtle bore him well. Once again, the creature is identified as primitive in its sad primeval motion swimming into the sunset. In the illustration, there is no mistaking the hawksbill turtle, Chelonia imbricata, taken directly from Lear's lithograph in the 1836 monograph, with just a tweak to the angle of the mouth and eyes to make the creature a shade more mournful and disdainful looking. The hawksbill was understood to have close links to extinct species known in fossil form. Darwin's studies of Galapagos life forms and studies of fossil reptiles drew attention to the link between living and extinct species. Thomas Bell, the scientific author of the Tortoise series, worked on the Reptiles volume of the studies emerging from Darwin's Voyage on the Beagle. The creature's gloomy and aloof character contrasts to comic effect with the pathetically hopeful-looking Yongi Bongi Bo, who gazes longingly backwards to the lady he leaves behind. Lear himself was forever wandering and solitary, drawn to the idea of marriage and companionship, but never making the move to involve himself irrevocably. The turtle, with its defensive shell, seems an apt image for Lear's cautious tendencies and the resilience of his character. As his career developed, Lear moved from illustration to landscape painting. His energetic travels across Europe and the Near East resulted in many thousands of delicate landscape studies that he worked up into watercolours and oils for sale and exhibition. His zoological training left him with a power of observation enhanced by a spell of association with the Pre-Raphaelite artist William Holman Hunt. He wrote notes on his sketches to remind him of colours and specifics. One watercolour, now in Harvard, was made in Albania in 1848. As so often, Lear worked over the sketch in sepia ink after the expedition to draw out the leading lines and to secure the faint pencil notes. Simple shades of blue and ochre watercolour are used to indicate the rocks, vegetation along the edge of a meandering stream featuring a primitive wooden water wheel, and hills. mosques and village houses are left white. The notes on the drawing tell us explicitly that he registered great beauty of colour. He wrote, "Ilex, bramble, willow, sloe," to remind himself of the plant forms, and mentioned houses peeping very blue-grey. Then, to secure the effect of the built forms and the distant trees against the mountains, he wrote, "Bright white mosques and indigo trees off purple hills." This was his ideal of beauty, where intensity of colour and harmonising variations, blue-grey, indigo, purple, pulled a landscape together. On another occasion, his notes identify yellow light and state, "Whole tone of view, cheery, greeny, corny." Colour brought with it emotion and the potential for intense pleasure. In many of Lear's paintings, the colour palette is intense, verging on gaudy. Lear wrote about the unequalled beauty of the exquisite plains of the coast that he was exploring the next year. The famous temple at Bassae was positioned in a beautiful landscape to be approached through magnificent forests of holly and oak. He painted a large-scale oil painting of the temple in 1854-5, which we can now see at the Fitzwilliam Museum. The glory of the gleaming columns shining against the blue mist-shrouded mountains and the openness of the grassy plain on which the temple is set are features of the middle distance of the work. There is a view through to the ever paler blue mauve of the far distance at the centre of the painting. These elements are contrasted to the angled, shaded rocks and greenery of the foreground. Our attention is first of all caught by a massive tree with bulbous trunk, which spreads a generous canopy of oak leaves across the picture. That tree dominates the picture and is a character in itself, a portly character with rotund, swollen trunk bellying out, age-thickened branches like a neck leaning forwards towards the temple, and attenuated twiggy limbs. Carrying on this fancy, we can recognise the slimmer tree alongside it as a lithe young figure, branches just crossing over those of its older neighbour. But the picture is animated by another creature in the foreground. Laboriously crawling over the rocks is a tortoise, we take to be the common European land tortoise, Testudo graeca, punningly a Greek tortoise for this view of a significant Greek temple. Climbing forwards and up the shallow angles of rocks would not bring this short-legged creature to a viewpoint, stretch its neck as it might. It will reach a chasm before it can attain to a viewing position. The picture offers the view of the temple on the plain as a precious goal. Lear can wishfully identify himself with the portly tree, happily sharing the pleasure with a companion tree, but equally he identifies ruefully with the tortoise toiling on in isolation and a long way from attaining amorous or aesthetic satisfaction. It poured with rain on the day after his visit to Bassae. The rain resulted in an extraordinary transformation. He wrote to his sister, "The plain of Argos is astonishingly beautiful. Ever since the reign of the 19th, the ground has become literally covered with flowers. I wish you could see them. Sometimes it is quite pink with hepaticas, scarlet and blue anemones, yellow euphorbia, cistus, and several hundred kinds of flowers I never saw before make the whole country a garden." When the ground was suddenly rainbow-hued, Lear could find an unmixed pleasure. This joy in colour allows him an intensified aesthetic response which has the power to dislodge his art from comedic melancholy. He goes beyond the paradox and inversions, important as one dimension of the nonsense writings, to another kind of glee. the investment in colour is like the abandonment to sheer nonsense. I suggest that in looking at the purple hills and indigo trees of Lear's paintings, we should recognise Lear's way of accessing joy. His response to the magical colours in the stripy rock, lush vegetation and brilliant flowers of Petra was one of untrammelled enthusiasm. He ascribes to his servant Giorgio the comment, "O master, we have come into a world where everything is made of chocolate, ham, curry powder and salmon." But surely this gives a clue to his own appetite for beauty in landscape and the pleasure he conveys to his viewers. In Lear's paintings, those browns, golds and delicate pinks really are delectable.
Tonight's The Essay, How Pleasant to Know Mr. Lear, was presented by Caroline R. Scott, and it was a Whistledown production for BBC Radio 3.
BBC Radio 3 Opera Guides. From Benjamin Britten to Richard Wagner, an introduction to some of opera's key works from Radio 3's Opera on 3 team.
There is nothing like the opening of Rheingold. You have to almost stop breathing. Very slowly, E-flat start, from the bottom of the Rhine. And it takes so long before you hear anything else, before a horn joins them. You know you're at the beginning of an epic.
Go online to bbc.co.uk/radio3 to find out more.